News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. You may have heard recently that New York City residents won't have to surrender their supersized sodas anytime soon after a judge blocked Mayor Michael Bloomberg's ban on sales of giant sugary drinks in his city. But debate over the mayor's approach rages on, and not just in the Big Apple. Nationally, Bloomberg's effort has again raised questions over what role, if any, government should play in curbing obesity. While there's no argument that Americans' growing waistlines are a huge threat to our nation, there's a lot of disagreement over whether government needs to step in and save us from ourselves. Those favoring such action say the obesity epidemic has become a public health crisis with astronomical costs in terms of health care expenses and lives lost or damaged due to weight-related diseases. But here's the other side. Efforts to deny people certain foods or drink can backfire, as any struggling dieter knows. Also, there's a slippery slope aspect to this. If today a city bans big sodas, what's on the docket for tomorrow? Large coffees? Big bowls of creamy chowder? Double stacks of pancakes? Or another food some public health official deems unhealthy? Today in The Exchange, where should government step in when it comes to obesity? At what point does a public health effort become an overactive nanny state? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have two guests. Joining us from D.C. is Michael Jacobson, co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Center for the Science and the Public Interest. He also serves as executive editor of the group's publication, Nutrition Action Health Letter. And Michael, good to have you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us is Professor David Just, behavioral economist with the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. And Professor Just, good to have you too. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, and to you, Professor Just, first, people often call this a public health crisis. What do you think? Agree or disagree?
Well, I agree. I think clearly, you know, we do have a public crisis where there are people who are a large number of people who are becoming obese, and it creates a drag on our economy as well as creates public cost in terms of Medicare and Medicaid expenses and other sorts of drags, expenses that we all face. So to that extent, I think we've got to consider this a public health crisis.
Yeah, and make the connection a little bit more for us, Professor Just. Again, you're the economist, you know, between one person's, you know, unhealthy habits that makes them obese and the next person who doesn't have those habits.
Sure. So, a lot of people compare this to smoking and things like that. And with smoking, you have this very clear, you know, I smoke and there's secondhand smoke that causes, you know, health problems for other people around me. Here, it's a little less clear. But in general, we know that the direct costs from obesity, from medical, you know, expenses, things like that, cost about $150 billion a year. And a large, large portion of that is due to people who are on some form of publicly funded medical care, either through Medicaid or Medicare. And so literally, you know, we spend our lives getting obese. And then when we end up on Medicare, then a lot of the public expenditure comes in to deal with all the problems we've sort of caused. And so our soda drinking or our other sorts of bad eating habits can actually have a negative impact on others.
Well, and never mind the personal toll that these diseases take. Yeah.
Well, and that number of you know, the cost to others gets quite large when we start considering other things like missing work or you know, other things that are caused by obesity.
Well, Michael Jacobson, I'm guessing you do think this is a public health crisis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I would certainly agree with everything that Professor just said. But just add what you alluded to of the personal anguish that so many people who are obese experience, you know, loss of self-confidence, less self-esteem, harder to get a job, derision in the workplace, you know, all those kinds of things that are so hurtful.
So if it's a public health crisis, Michael Jacobson, and I know you feel that way, does it deserve then some kind of public, meaning government, response?
It certainly does. You know, the government wants to protect itself from the costs that Professor Just talked about, and I think it has a moral obligation to step in and help people. You know, all the private sector hasn't worked. You know, there are a zillion books on dieting, countless dietary supplements that are worthless that that people have heard about. So I think Mayor Bloomberg realizes that we need a public intervention, something stronger, a little stronger medicine than's been tried before. And he's done a number of things. One of the things that hopefully will go into effect nationally, it's been in effect in New York City for several years, is calorie labeling at chain restaurants. That's a modest measure that would just provide people with more information. And his second foray into this area is to limit the size of soft drinks in restaurants, movie theaters, stadiums, the jurisdictions, the venues over which the city has some control. And he's, you know, it's funny. He's the limit is supposedly an austere 16 ounces, but that, of course, is bigger than anything people consumed 50 years ago.
Sure. I remember a Coke was 12 ounces, and that was it, right? I mean, it was a can.
Well, if you are a little bit older, my generation, we remember 6.5 ounce Coke back in the early 50s.
Well, what do you think, David Just? I mean, there's a couple different efforts that Michael talks about, and we'll get into detail of those in just a minute. One is sort of providing information. Another is a little stricter, sort of banning certain products. But more broadly first, Professor Just, please, if this is a public health crisis, as you both said, does it deserve some kind of public, meaning government, response? And what should that response look like, Professor Just?
Well, so I think to the extent that we are facing this public cost from this problem, we clearly have some role for government in trying to deal with this. I guess where we start to differ is over what that response should be. What we're looking for really is not narrow changes in how people behave. For example, soda is not the whole problem. It's a piece of the problem. It's a piece of the puzzle, but it's a very narrow piece of it, and dealing with just that won't conquer obesity. And so to a certain extent, I feel like these efforts have both sort of underreached and overreached. and underreached in that they're not going to go far enough to actually make much of a change, and overreached in the fact that they're not making much of a change, and they're also so, in the face of the consumer that it has the problem, that they're not going to help change their mind and their lifestyle. They're going to cause them more to resent these types of policies and push back on them.
Like a dieter who denies herself dessert, and then one Tuesday night at midnight she says, I can't stand it anymore, and she runs to the fridge and pulls out the ice cream carton.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to change things, it's the people who are overeating, it's the people who are taking in too many calories or not exercising enough that we really need to help change. And those are the people who are the most likely to resist these efforts, these particular efforts, because they do look like they're reaching in and saying, we're not going to let you do what you want to do. And that's, there's this natural, psychological reaction we have to that. We push back.
So, Professor Just, so what does an appropriate response look like? If you don't like the sort of Bloomberg approach, what does work, in your opinion, in terms of public health crisis, public response?
I think there are two sorts of principles that I'd look at as being really important in trying to respond to something like this. And the first is finding a way to work with consumers' own desires, right? And so, we do have a growing body of knowledge that tells us that there are some very subtle sorts of cues in our environment when we make decisions that can guide us towards healthier or less healthy decisions. And if without taking choices away, we can just lead people towards smaller sizes, making sure that maybe not the 6.5, but an 8 ounce soda or something like that, or at the very least the 12 ounce soda is available and appears to be sort of the norm, we're going to see much bigger changes in soda consumption than we would by simply banning everything above 16 ounces. Which actually may draw people much closer to the 16 ounces who were trying to get smaller amounts before. The other sort of principle, you know, not just working with the individual to sort of lead them naturally to healthier items, but also looking at the manufacturers. And, you know, this is where I think we could go a lot more broadly, because it's not soda that's really the problem. It's calorie intake and it's calorie expenditure. You know, if, for example, we, we taxed added sugar as an ingredient, right? That hits a lot broader set of food items and will drive the manufacturers who don't have these same sort of emotional responses. They respond pretty, you know, coldly and calculatedly to any sort of policy towards other types of substitutes that might be healthier.
Well, and Michael Jacobson, I know you have some thoughts there. I want to quickly give out the phone number. It's 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. And real quick, too, Michael Jacobson, let's just take Professor Just's first point, because we're heading into a break. Work with individual consumers' own desires. Lead them to healthier choices. What do you think, Michael?
Well, that's very nice and certainly should be included, but it's hopeless. You know, to change 4 million cafeterias, 100 million families individually is virtually impossible. And that's why we need some higher leverage steps. And things start with soda pop, because that is the only food or beverage that's been demonstrated to promote weight gain. And it's for several reasons. One is we consume so much of it. And also it's a liquid, and beverages are more conducive to weight gain than foods. But, you know, I hope that Professor Just had supported Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Patterson in New York when they tried to raise sugar taxes, or actually a soda tax, because that's where it would it's easier to have an impact. But we need soda taxes. We need warnings on soda. We'd be beneficial to have limits on serving sizes. And major education campaigns. And I'm talking about investing billions of dollars for national campaigns that would aim not just to reduce calories or soda, but to encourage people to eat fruits and vegetables and whole grains and other healthy foods.
Okay, Michael, I'm going to cut you off there, but I will let you finish up after a short break, and we'll take your calls in just a minute, so stay with us.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and more on the government versus obesity on the exchange. And at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. Supreme Court confronts same-sex marriage. Are you enjoying the conversation you're hearing on NHPR? Well, great programs like The Exchange are made possible with the financial help of our listeners. Now it's even easier to make a donation to your favorite public radio service. Every time you text NHPR to 85944, a $10 donation will appear on your next phone bill. Just text NHPR to 85944 and thanks. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Cordova Sculpture Park and Museum in Lincoln, Massachusetts. 30 acres of contemporary art set in an idyllic outdoor landscape, closer than you think. Details at decordova.org. And Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people in needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899, online at mascomabank.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what is government's role in fighting the obesity epidemic, if any? Give us your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests are Professor David Just, behavioral economist with the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University, and also Michael Jacobson, co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Center for the Science and the Public Interest. Go ahead, Michael, finish up your point, please, and then we'll go to our listeners.
Well, the larger point is we have an obesity epidemic. Government needs to get involved, and it needs to do a whole range of things, including major education campaigns to promote overall healthier diets. And it could use government programs like the food stamp program, school lunches, and so on to do that. And we need specific policy measures that government can take, like taxing soft drinks, subsidizing fruit and vegetable consumption, especially through schools and food stamp programs, warning notices on soft drinks, calorie labeling, at restaurants. And some of these things are coming about. You know, some of these things, you know, Professor Just said soda isn't the only problem. Of course not. But people are tackling various aspects. So there's a federal law now that will soon kick into effect on calorie labeling at restaurants. School lunches are being cleaned up, and now the Department of Agriculture is moving on to the foods and beverages and vending machines in schools. So, you know, some of these things have to be tackled piecemeal. So there's a lot of attention on Bloomberg's proposal to limit serving sizes, but that's one piece of the puzzle. Other pieces are being worked on also, and being opposed by the affected industries.
And I see some overlap between you and Professor Just's positions, taxing on soft drinks, for example. Professor Just, hold on if you could. I want to bring our listeners into our conversation, too. A couple emails that have come in. exchange@nhpr.org is where you can join in by email or call 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to our callers first. Bob's waiting in Laconia. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I understand the obesity problem. Consuming food is one way a person can get satisfaction at any point in time during the day and in just about any location. And I also understand it's a challenge to lose weight, because if you ask me to gain 25 pounds over the next month, I could easily do that. If you ask me to lose 25, that would be quite a challenge and very discouraging. However, having said that, I believe that overweight, obese people should be paying more because it's costing me more, not being obese. It's costing me more because of their obesity and the cost in the health.
So pay more for health insurance? Is that what you're saying, Bob?
Yes, exactly. I understand there's been an employer who's recently done that. And I'll take a response off the air.
Okay, this comes up a lot. Thanks, Bob, for bringing it to our conversation. Professor Just, what do you think?
Well, I think it certainly makes a lot more sense than charging everybody for soda consumption, because it's much more the problem is you know, the cost of health care. I also think, you know, the real problem with it, though, is we really need to win the hearts and minds of those who are at risk of obesity. And we aren't going to do that by getting in their face and punishing them. We're going to do that in very, very different ways that more gently lead them towards better behavior.
So, Professor, just do insurance companies now, can insurance companies now charge somebody who's 50 pounds or 100 pounds overweight? Can you charge that person more right now or not?
I'm not familiar with all the laws everywhere, but I do know, you know, certainly there are places where that is allowed, that you can charge more for those who are overweight. Or, you know, there are employers that are you know, giving differential benefits depending on the weight of their employer.
Wow. Is that fair, Michael Jacobson? I mean, what if somebody just, you know, comes from a big family, they got big bones? I mean, is it really fair to charge a person a whole lot more money just because they're big?
You know, I'm not sure. I know some companies are giving lower rates to people who are essentially fit, you know, a regular body weight, lower cholesterol level, and so on. And I don't know the laws, and it's an ethical thicket once you get into these. And, you know, my organization has worked on approaches that seem challenging, but a little more kind of obvious.
Yeah, although I got to say, I mean, I don't like to get into my personal stuff here, but I'm fit, but I do have high cholesterol. Just genetic, inherited it, you know, working on it. But, you know, at some level, it's not really my fault, Michael. So is it really fair to charge me more?
You know, I'm not sure. And I think I'm going to withhold judgment, Laura, while you work on your diet and exercise.
Well, I'm already doing pretty well there. But hey, all right. Thank you very much for that call. It's a great point and one that comes up a lot. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Now, here's one gentleman that just came in from Christopher in Manchester. He says, as much as I'm appalled by the monumental sizes of these drinks, especially at the movie theaters, I feel there's a hint of elitism in the movement to limit the personal choices others make through outright banning. Education and exercise make more sense to me. Christopher, thanks for chiming in. What do you think, Michael? I'll go to you first.
Well, there's so many ways that government gets involved in our lives, and I don't know if you'd call them all paternalistic or elitist in terms of trying to cut air pollution. You know, does driving a big gas guzzler deprive people of certain rights? So I don't. And then you know, you think of limits on different pollutants and food additives and safety of consumer products and so on. The government, I think, our society and Europe and Japan and other technologically advanced societies have concluded this is the only way that we can protect the public's welfare. When you have these huge industries trying to cut every corner to market as much of their product as possible, who's going to defend the consumer? And it's too much to put the whole burden on individuals. And for obesity, yes, people who are overweight, we need to help them, and they need to work on exercise and diet and so on, and the other contributing factors to their overweight. So I disagree with that caller.
You disagree, and yet, you know, if, again, as I said in the introduction, if the city bans sodas today, I mean, is it large coffees at Starbucks tomorrow? Is it, you know, double stacks of pancakes the next day? You know what I'm trying to get at, Michael? There's a slippery slope aspect for this, around this for a lot of people.
Well, that's the argument that that the opponents use. The industry certainly loves that. But if for sodas, the reason there's so much focus is that's the one food or beverage that's been demonstrated in clinical studies and also seen in epidemiology studies to promote weight gain. And that's the place to start, and it may be the place to end. But the slippery slope argument is used on everything that people disagree with. There isn't a slippery slope everywhere, face it.
Sometimes the slope stops at soda.
That's right.
What do you think, Professor Just, on our emailer's point, hint of elitism, and also this other point about, you know, are bans really the way to go about this?
Well, so first I've got to agree with the elitism. This is a movement that's primarily pushed by people who are of a class that doesn't drink soda. And soda drinkers tend to be those who have lower incomes. And this is a push about soda and not you know, high-calorie coffee drinks that the upper class drink. And I believe there's a reason for that, that this is really reaching into, you know, lower class, lower socioeconomic status individuals and trying to play with their lives because we know better. So to that point, I think it's right. And with the slippery slope argument, well, we do have clinical trials that show that soda does increase our weight, that it does promote weight gain. But we don't have anything that says that this is our primary cause of the obesity epidemic. And in fact, we have study after study showing that the particular types of policies that are being promoted are very ineffective at discouraging obesity. And so I think this is a slippery slope. We're starting to meddle in people's lives without really having much justification.
So you're saying it's not just the soda, you know, it's inactive lifestyles, people don't walk to work, kids would rather play video games than go outside and so forth. It's the big kahuna, not just one particular drink.
It's everything. That's right. That's right.
Well, I know you've got some thoughts, Michael. Lots more calls, though. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Carol's waiting in Nashua. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a couple of, well, listening to everybody talking, I don't, you were saying that the people that are in government incentives are the ones that are consuming a lot and having a lot of problems with their health because the food is so cheap, they can buy the cheaper food. Actually, I think you should maybe target the companies that are producing this food. I don't think it's fair to target the consumers when the consumers, they don't have enough money to buy healthier food. Maybe you should take away all these stock incentives or tax incentives to go to these large companies and instead give incentives to people who produce smaller amounts of food, smaller farmers, smaller producers. It's not fair to go after the consumers with taxes.
So government policies themselves are encouraging poor eating habits, Carol. Go after it that way?
They encourage people, the large companies that produce the food.
Yeah, you know, other
they give tax incentives to these big companies like Coca-Cola. Mayor Bloomberg might not drink Coke, but he might possibly, or his friends have a portion of the company and be interested in the bottom line of the company itself.
Okay, well, thanks for calling. Yeah, and, you know, Michael, some people have talked about this, that, and I think you included, government policies themselves in some way encourage poor eating habits, subsidies that create artificially low sugar prices, policies that support consumption of processed foods. What do you see there, Michael?
Well, people have talked a lot about corn subsidies, lowering the price of corn and then high fructose corn syrup and soft drinks. There's really no truth to that. Corn subsidies now have no effect on the price of soft drinks. So set that one aside. One question is, there's a program called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, aimed at promoting nutrition among low-income people.
We used to call it food stamps, right?
Food stamp program. And there's a lot of controversy over, so that program doesn't allow food stamps to be used for vitamin pills, say, or a baked potato at Wendy's. But it does allow people to use them for soft drinks, sugary drinks of all kinds. And so there's a lot of debate now about should that government policy that says food stamps can be used for soda but not vitamin pills, is that appropriate? Or how could food stamps be used to promote fruits and vegetables? But there's, and Mayor Bloomberg wanted to do an experiment to see what the effect would be of not allowing food stamps to be used for soda purchases. So that's, you know, that's a government policy that could be addressed, and the anti-hunger groups don't like it. The soda industry hates it because people buy roughly $4 billion a year worth of sugar drinks with food stamps. So that's one government policy. But I'm not sure what kind of government policies the caller is thinking of that would punish the companies or penalize the companies, not punish them. And help us on our way towards a slimmer nation.
Well, here's an email from Bob and Sullivan that kind of gets to what I think Carol was saying. Bob says, why is it that the consumer always gets blamed for being weak-willed and eating too much when, in fact, the food corporations are designing and marketing highly addictive foods? So I think that's partly what she was talking about. What do you think about Bob's comment, Professor Just?
So I can agree with part of what he said, we don't really see much contribution of corn prices or things like that to soda prices. There is an element behind this where corn prices could determine what or how much sweetener soda companies decide to use, as well as other companies, how much they decide to mix into their recipes. And so there it can play a role. But in actuality, our government subsidies are so small at this point that they're not really having any sort of impact. When it comes to, you know, thinking about food stamps, I what we're talking about, the average food stamp recipient is spending $13 a month on soda. And, you know, you can have a question as to whether that's too much to spend or too little to spend on soda, or you know, a reasonable amount. But what I think you'd have to concede is taking $13 away from people probably wouldn't cause them to change their behavior much. They'd just spend that $13 out of their pocket. And in fact, there's a very good economist out of Northwestern who just made this argument in the Christian Science Monitor that we wouldn't expect this to really change people's behavior very much in the end. It'd just be something that's very in your face to the food stamp recipients and potentially lead some to push back.
Well, and here's another question coming out of Bob's email. And Bob, thank you for that one. So we've heard from a couple of people, you know, what about the companies? You know, aren't they promoting this bad food? And as Carol said, maybe the government is helping them create this quote unquote bad food. Here's the question, though, for both of you. Professor Just, you first, please. You know, in terms of blame the companies, nobody's making you or me or Michael eat the bag of Oreos. That's our choice. We are the ones making those bad decisions. It's not the company's fault. That's the argument. What do you think, Professor Just?
Well, you've got to agree. I mean, the problem, as I see it, is, you know, the companies are responding to our own bad behavior. Now, at the same time, we make so many food decisions in a day that we're not making those decisions very cognitively. You can spout as much health information at us as you want, and it's not going to change our behavior. But in the moment, right, in that moment, the things that look attractive to us, and usually the things that have the most calories, those are the things that are going to attract us, the things that are convenient, the things that we think are going to taste good. And there is where the problem lies, is we have these sort of instincts that lead us towards bad behavior, and these companies are sort of responding to that. And that's where I think, you know, if there's a role for government, it's trying to fix this puzzle so that our companies can thrive and our individuals can thrive. And so we're not, standing in the way of consenting adults, making a transaction.
Yeah, although people, Professor Just, have always loved French fries, they've always loved Oreos. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but, and yet it's been pointed out that even though we've always loved our treats and sweets, we didn't start ballooning as a nation until, 1990. So something must have changed. Did we get more weak-willed, or was there just all of a sudden more food available?
We had a lot of innovation in food technology just prior to that time. You do find a lot of sort of tracking changes. It makes it very difficult to figure out what's exactly going on. I've been to a conference at the Institute of Medicine where there were a bunch of researchers in this area. And at the end, the guy who was summarizing all of our arguments said, well, in the end, we really don't know what's doing this. We can't point the finger at one single thing. We know people are exercising less. We know that they're taking in more calories. And we don't really know what led them to all of this. So it's very hard to point the finger.
All right. Going into a break. So Michael Jacobson, hold off. I really want your thoughts on that, too. Do we blame the person at McDonald's? Do we blame McDonald's themselves? We'll talk about that after a short break. We'll also keep taking your calls and emails, so keep them coming. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on Facebook and stay with us.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making. PaxWorld.com for tomorrow. And Waste Management, with a reminder to practice the 4 R's wherever possible: reduce, reuse, recycle, and recover the resource. Additional information at thinkgreen.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR keeps you up to speed with what's going on, whether it's breaking news from across the state or the other side of the world. And now it's even easier with the new NHPR app, available for iPhone or Droid. Of course, you can stream us wherever you are and share stories with friends, but the newest feature is for your NHPR member card. The app finds the nearest businesses to you that honor the card and updates the directory every month to include the newest discounts. Download the NHPR app today.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, UNH President Mark Huddleston is here on the challenges and opportunities facing his university. Email us your questions for President Huddleston before the program if you'd like. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. And then join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, does government have a role in fighting obesity, given what we know about the tremendous public health costs? But at what point do public health efforts in this area become government overreach, the so-called nanny state? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go back to our listeners, gentlemen, Michael Jacobson, I'd love your thoughts on this idea, too. You know, no one's forcing me to go to McDonald's. If people, wanted very healthy meals over Big Macs, they wouldn't be going there. And yet McDonald's is a highly successful business. So nobody's making us do this. We're doing it ourselves.
Well, with a little help from the companies, let me answer that, but also get back to the question that the previous caller raised about wanting to focus on companies, not the consumer. And we've suggested a few things and had some observations about other things. One is, you know, when it comes to soft drinks, it's not totally up to us. Coca-Cola, just Coca-Cola, forget the other companies, spends about $2 billion a year marketing its sugary drinks in the United States, and billions more elsewhere. But $2 billion a year is an enormous force that works on us in different ways to get us to buy more of their sugar drinks. Children, and then getting away, one other step, that, so what can you do? You can tax that. You can say junk foods should not, companies should not have an exemption, a tax subsidy for marketing junk foods. And the same thing goes for junk food advertising on children's television. You know, if you want to narrow the scope of a measure, require the don't allow taxes to be deducted. Don't allow advertising expenses to be a business deducted as a business expense when you're figuring out taxes when it's advertising junk foods to kids. That's something government could do. Who focuses on industry? And back on soda, we've actually the Department of Agriculture and Department of Health and Human Services agree that Americans are consuming far too much refined sugars, and almost half comes from soda pop.
But Michael, my point is, no one's making me have soda instead of water. I'm making that choice.
Nobody has a gun to your head.
Right.
But when the companies are spending $2 billion a year, one company, encouraging people to drink their junk, that has an effect. It creates a social norm. It shows, it indicates you can be healthy and beautiful and young if you drink this junk.
But haven't companies always advertised stuff like that? I mean, for decades, right? I mean,
well, it's been, certainly it's been increasing, you know, an increasing sophistication over the last 30, 40, 50 years. It's not the only factor. And, you know, when you focus on any factor, the opponents could always say, oh, it's not just that, it's a whole bunch of things. But it gets down to saying, where can we have some impact?
I see. So you got to get started somewhere. You're agreeing that it's exercise, it's inactivity, and so forth. Right.
Of course it is. And so, I mean, you could say building the interstate highways was a cause of obesity. Cheaper cars is a cause of obesity. I mean, there are a zillion things. You can't work on them all. So you try to work on the ones that are most obvious, would have the greatest impact, most cost-effective. And there are things that government could do. Industry could do it on its own, but it's not going to.
Okay.
Like taking caffeine out of soda. Caffeine is a mildly addictive drug.
Although now they say caffeine, at least in coffee, is good for strokes and so forth. Maybe we won't go there right now this hour. I do want to bring some of our listeners back into our conversation. Katie's calling from Salem. Hi, Katie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, Katie.
So I just wanted to comment on the FDA and their involvement in allowing certain food items to go out on the market, including artificial sweeteners, which lab rats and cockroaches won't even eat, but we will feed it to our children and our adults, which is carcinogenic, as well as studies being shown that they've done genetic manipulation on foods to make it so that it's never quite satisfying, so you end up eating a whole bag of Doritos rather than having a few and stopping there.
I see. So food deliberately made slightly less than feeling full so that you keep going, Katie. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and mostly the FDA does have a big hand in allowing certain things to go out on the market, and I'll take my comments off air.
Okay, Katie, thanks a lot. And Professor Just, go ahead on that, please.
Well, so, you know, there's no question that we've gotten pretty advanced in food science. I don't know that we're quite as high tech as it may be portrayed. I do think, you know, there certainly is this element of we tend to eat an entire bag of or a bowl of whatever is in front of us. But this is also something that's been going on forever. We don't tend to think after each Dorito we put into our mouth, wow, that was great. Should I have another? Instead, we just keep going because it's too taxing mentally to do otherwise. You know, is there a role for FDA? I do worry about some of the addictive substances such as caffeine in soda and things like that. But I somehow think that's a little beside the point for most of this argument over obesity.
Katie, thanks for the call. Let's take another one. This is Chris in Corinth, Vermont. Hi, Chris, you're on the exchange. Go ahead.
I just want to know, you know, what's the matter with you people flirting with the idea that government should have any more control over people's choices in a free country? The key words being control and free. As far as not being an individual's fault for obesity and high cholesterol, they're consequences of living in life. Each person should accept their own consequences and live life accordingly. And I hear a lot of talk about fairness. Freedom is fair. I will take my response off the air. Thank you.
Chris, thank you very much. And Michael, we talked about this a little before, but address it again. Chris, thank you.
Well, you know, that's a basic philosophical question. Should government do anything to take any kind of interventions to promote the public's health and welfare? And a lot of us think, yes, the public should, especially when you have these multi-billion dollar industries, you know, extremely sophisticated, hiring all kinds of psychologists and food technologists to make their products irresistible. Who's going to protect the consumer if it's not government? And, you know, so I think that's a little simplistic.
Sounds like Chris doesn't want protection, though. He feels like your version of protection, Michael, is his version of infringing on his freedom to make choices.
Until he needs the government to bail him out after a snowstorm.
So you would say to him, you know, his choices eventually end up costing Medicare money. And that's where the connection is.
No, I think it's much broader than that. You know, it sounds like he's willing to accept, allow industry to do whatever it wants to make a profit from the American consumer, regardless of the unscrupulous methods they use. And I think, no, it's not fair. But, you know, obviously, live free or die is a slogan up in New Hampshire, and a lot of people believe in it, and we have a controversy that eventually gets sorted out by legislatures, public opinion, polls, Congress, regulatory agencies like the FDA, which should, going back to the previous caller, should ban certain artificial sweeteners because they have caused cancer in animals.
Yeah, and we have gotten an email, Matt in Nashua. I won't read the whole one, but Matt also having some concerns about the health impacts of the artificial sweeteners. Let's go next to Keene, where Becky's waiting. Hi, Becky. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to kind of go back a little bit earlier. My daughter and I are food stamp recipients, and you know, it's not a lot of money, but it makes a huge difference to us. But it really saddens me to see people make bad decisions with taxpayer money, and I know that does really bother some people with government overreach, but at the same time, people's poor choices eventually do filter down and cost everyone money. So I think maybe a little bit of regulation or guidance at this point might be necessary because what's currently happening isn't working.
So you'd be okay, Becky, with government saying, as somebody suggested earlier, hey, food stamp recipients, you can't use those food stamps for soda anymore. You'd be okay with that?
Well, it seems to make sense because it just doesn't seem to be working the way it is right now. Something needs to happen.
So, so everybody's targeting sodas as the boogeyman, and certainly there are some studies showing big problems. But what if the government also said, Becky, hey, Becky, you also can't use those food stamps for, potato chips?
I'd be fine with that.
Yeah.
Personally.
What about pancakes or, you know, high-fat cheese? I mean, I'm just wondering where you draw the line.
And that's the hard thing. I don't have that answer.
Yeah.
That's the hard thing. And I do understand that, but I know that it costs a lot of people a lot of money from everything from diabetes to uninsured ER trips. So.
Okay. Becky, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it. Professor Just, could you jump in on Becky's point, please?
Well, certainly there are going to be some people on food stamps as well as people off food stamps who are completely okay with that. The argument that's been made that I think resonates with me most is it's not going to be everybody. There are going to be some people who see that, and that's going to, you know, create enough of a barrier to them that, that they say, I'm just going to avoid food stamps, even though, you know, it would provide my family with better nutrition and better health. This is why a lot of the hunger advocates are really, really against this. And again, the point, you know, we're talking about $13 a month. So, you know, even if there's only one person in the household, we're talking like a soda every couple days. It's not going to be the difference between obesity and being normal weight, more than likely.
Here's an email that came in from Krista. Thank you again for that call. This is kind of long, but I want to read it anyway. Krista in Portsmouth. Can you please talk about the fact that oftentimes being overweight, being obese, is directly related to a mental health issue, which we would never suggest charging people more money for any other realm? If someone has an addiction to alcohol, for instance, can you imagine charging them more money for their insurance? Overweight people are discriminated against in our society. Penalties and punishments only perpetuate this. They do not address the underlying causes of overeating. That's one issue from Krista. She raises another issue, but let's tackle that one, gentlemen. Michael Jacobson first, what do you think?
Well, I think she raises an important point that depression in particular is a cause of overeating and obesity.
And some of the drugs make people gain weight and so forth, yeah.
That's some of the drugs used to treat the depression.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, and it's terribly unfortunate. And we need to, if we're going to solve the obesity problem, we need to address the mental health problems that go along with it. And we're probably stuck with those drugs. Drug companies are always working on new drugs for conditions like depression. And that's, you know, similar to your statement of about having high cholesterol levels. Should you be charged more for some condition that really you didn't choose?
Right.
And depression is exactly the same kind of thing, and it's and that's why there's so much controversy about fiddling with insurance rates.
What about her comment? Overweight people are discriminated against in our society. Penalties and punishments only perpetuate this. That's very thoughtful, Krista. Thank you. What do you think, Michael? Just real quick on that, and then I want to hear from Professor Just too.
Well, there certainly is discrimination, but I'm not sure about the second part about the perpetuation. So, but, you know, I guess what I would like to do is focus more on where we can have an impact on obesity. And I think it will be through broad societal measures like limiting junk food advertising, charging more for soft drinks, improving school foods, major community education programs to get the whole state of New Hampshire eating healthier diets.
Professor Just, what do you think about Krista's point? Thank you, Krista.
Well, I appreciate Krista's point, and there is a lot of evidence out there of discrimination based on weight in all kinds of things, hiring, salary, you name it. There's very good evidence of it. When it comes to charging insurance rates, I feel your pain. This is something that's you know, much like these government programs that we're talking about, it's so in your face that it's repulsive, and it can help perpetuate obesity. But the other issue you have to deal with is, you know, it does cost more for the health care of individuals who are overweight, even if that them being overweight isn't their fault. And so you've got to divide that cost up somehow. And be it, you know, if you say you can't charge anybody different insurance rates, then you're saying, you know, corporations have to pay for that difference in cost, and they have to pay the cost of obesity. Otherwise, it has, you know, if they can charge whatever they want, then you're forcing all that cost on the individual, whether they were the cause of their obesity or not. Maybe we should actually find something sort of more in the middle where it's a shared cost. But it's a difficult question to deal with one way or the other.
And go ahead, Professor Just. Yeah.
Well, just that, you know, there may actually be some justification for discrimination in some cases.
Speaking of middle ground, I was interested to hear you, Professor Just, and you, Michael Jacobson, say at the very beginning that one area where you both seem to agree was posting calorie counts in fast food restaurants. Am I right about that, Michael? You think that would be a good idea?
Yeah, we worked 10 years to get a federal law passed on that.
And is that coming anywhere in New York City? Is that what you said?
Well, it's in New York City. It's in California, a number of other jurisdictions. We're waiting for the Food and Drug Administration to finalize regulations to implement the law. The movie theater industry is fighting it. The vending machine industry is fighting it. But the basic thrust, I think, will go through and regulations will be finalized in a few months.
All right. Well, guys, this has been really interesting. Thank you very much for taking the time out on a Monday morning for us. Michael Jacobson, great to have you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
Michael Jacobson, co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Center for the Science and the Public Interest. Professor David Just, thank you also very much.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Professor David Just, behavioral economist with the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with Mark Huddleston, president of the University of New Hampshire. After years of dealing with state budget cuts, now he's hoping UNH will receive more funding. We'll talk about that, also pressure on him to keep costs down in light of burgeoning student debt. We'll also cover some major initiatives ongoing at UNH, including a focus on sustainability. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR. Becoming cloudy across central and southern New Hampshire today with highs 40 to 45 degrees. Northern New Hampshire will see some...